I am Bert, and I'm an alcoholic. You guys are lucky I wore heels, because this is really tall. Anyway, I'm really glad to be here tonight. Thank you, and thanks, Paul, for asking me to speak. And thank you to all my friends that are here tonight, because I feel really blessed that I'm looking across and seeing faces that are familiar, and that helps me a lot, because I'm kind of nervous. But I also want to welcome the newcomers. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you think you have a problem with drinking, you're in the right place. If you think you have a problem with thinking, you're definitely in the right place. Because I think that's what I found out here, you know, after I got a little bit of physical sobriety, that most of the problem was occurring in my head. I have a thinking problem. And alcohol was my solution, and I had to kind of be willing to learn new solutions, to be here and to work the steps and to take the time to find out other ways to do life, because I didn't know. I had no idea. So anyway, just to tell you a little bit about myself, I won't give you a long, long boring, but I come from a fairly normal family, and I was born in Cuba in 1958. I'm 52, I'll save you the math. And the thing that was different for me was that, like, my mom and dad were divorced before I was born, so I lived just with my mom and with my grandmother, and, you know, it was just kind of a quiet little life. And in 1962, we had to escape from Cuba. My grandfather was a judge in Cuba, and he was able to get us out of there. And so when I came to the United States, I was 4 years old, and I lived in Miami Beach at a time when no one spoke Spanish. So it was really, really weird, you know, like I already had the alcoholism, you know, the gene was there. So I have an issue with feeling a part of and feeling left out and all that kind of stuff that we all kind of go through. But on top of that, I just didn't know what anybody was saying, and that made it a lot more difficult. And also, it was just, you know, I had a different kind of family, you know, because it was just me and my mom and my grandmother. I felt different than the other kids. I didn't have any siblings. I didn't have a dad. You know, we lived in a one-room hotel room. And so I just felt really, really different and left out. And so for a really long time, I had a hard time connecting with people. And, you know, shooting forward, by the time I was, you know, in junior high, my mom had remarried, and I had a stepbrother and a stepsister, and, you know, I was kind of almost having a normal life. But, you know, and I don't say this because I don't mean any disrespect to my parents, because I think they did the best job that they could do. But my mom was broken in her own way, and so when I was a kid and I had a stepbrother and a stepsister, she would say, like, if they got $7 and I got a dollar for allowance, she'd go, just take what you can get. Just be happy that you got that. You know, don't make any waves. And so I grew up thinking that second best was good enough, you know, and that I could take whatever I could get and just be glad with that. And so I just had this idea that I was not good enough, you know, that I was second best. And I understand that that was my mom's way of coping, you know, and I'm happy to say my mother is in Al-Anon today, and she works a pretty good program, and we have a great relationship. But, you know, at that time, that was really hard for me to really internalize. And so when I was a pretty young teenager, I went to this Joe Cocker concert with a bunch of my friends, and somebody passed me a joint. And, you know, two hits, and I felt good. Like, I was in my skin, and I was having fun, and I connected with everybody at the concert, and, you know, and all of a sudden I found this solution so that I could feel okay in my own skin and be comfortable. And that would continue to be my solution for a really, really long time, you know. I went through high school getting loaded every day and went to junior college. I started, you know, photography and different things, and I was able to show up for work and cope much better because it just kind of took the edge off. And I actually didn't start drinking until I was 21. It just wasn't something that was available to me. I am a total alcoholic. I don't mean any disrespect to the program. There's just drugs in my story. But I did everything alcoholically, like everything that I do. You know, I do school alcoholically. I do sports alcoholically. Everything that I do, I want to do to the extreme. And I don't have an off button. It wasn't factory installed. So I'm glad that I came here and I could learn how to, you know, temper that. So anyway, when I was in my early 20s, I met my husband, and he loved to drink, and so he taught me how, and I was really, really good at it. And the thing that I really liked was amphetamines along with alcohol, because then I could drink much longer, you know what I mean? It kept me going. So, you know, we got into that habit. But, you know, at that time in my life, it was working for me because I was in my 20s. I lived in San Diego. We were partying. We were having fun. And then we moved to Mammoth. And talk about having fun. I mean, living in Mammoth Lake when you're in your early 20s, this was the 80s. It was great. So the way that my life looked was that I would ski during the day, and then I'd go to work. And then we'd start drinking during our shift. I worked at the Chart House up there. And then, you know, there was always some great drug dealer that was, you know, pulling out lines for us. And as soon as my shift was over, we'd party as late as we could until we ran out of dope. And then I'd sleep for a little while, get up and ski and do the whole thing again. And I thought that was great. Like, to me, what else would you ever want? I mean, that was perfect. And it was fun. And it was like one of those things where, you know, I had a lot of friends and we would go to Tahoe or to Death Valley. We'd go camping. We would do really fun stuff. And so drugs and alcohol were not standing in the way of my ability to do life, you know, at that point. But I did notice that after a while that everybody else would taper off and I was still wanting more. And I could tell that there was a little bit of a difference between the way that I partied and the way that they partied. And pretty soon, you know, it would be kind of hard to get up and go skiing, or, you know, I'd have a terrible hangover. And I didn't miss a lot of work or do any of that, but I could tell that my disease was starting to creep up on me. And you know how they say that you can look along the line and see a timeline, and I can see where I was at that point, and I was off to a start, you know. And lucky for me, I decided to have a child, and so that kind of just put everything on hold because I was able to just focus on being pregnant and having my children and, you know, being present for my daughter. So that kind of took, put everything just on hold for a little while, and then we moved to Orange County, and as soon as my kid was like a couple years old and we started making a little bit of money, all of a sudden it's Coke on the weekends, and you know. And I thought that because I could say, okay, I'm not going to use Monday through Thursday, that that meant that I wasn't an alcoholic because I could just, you know, save my dope or only drink on Friday and Saturday night and then act normal the rest of the time. But the truth of the matter is that it just kept creeping up on me. And, you know, I was thinking about, like, when I lived in Mammoth, we went and floated the Owens River one 4th of July, and we were having such a good time, and, you know, we were doing dope, and we were having fun, and we were drinking, and, you know, it was just like this golden, magical day out there, and I thought, wow, it's just never going to be any better than this. And the truth of the matter was is that it never was any better than that. It just never got any better, you know. From that point on, I needed, you know, bigger rivers, bigger boats, more dope, more, you know, more friends. It's just like there wasn't enough to make that work for me. And so I think that my using career, I swear I just chased that feeling for the rest of my drinking and using career because I just never got that magic again, you know. So one of the things that would prevent me from getting too crazy was the fact that that, you know, I couldn't afford to buy as many drugs as I wanted to or do everything. But as my husband's career started taking off, I started having more access to anything that I wanted to do because he was really successful and we had a lot of money. And so there was just no end to the amount of drugs that I could buy and how long I could party. And I didn't have any accountability, really, because I was a stay-at-home mom. So I could be the Kool-Aid mom on the outside and then have, you know, bag in my pocket and go be, you know, like room mom, loaded. And, you know, looking back, I feel so bad that my children never had to go through that. But they didn't really know what was going on. So after a while, that stopped working for me, and I just decided, okay, I'm done. I'm done with this marriage. This guy's starting, he stopped wanting to get loaded, and it started getting in the way of my using. So I decided, okay, then I'm just going to go over here and do what I want to do. And I left in a blaze of glory and had an affair and blew up my marriage and did all the things that we do when we're out there. And got a house across the street from Pines Park that I rented, and I was like, I'm an artist. I'm going to lead this bohemian lifestyle, you know. So I had, like, you know, a dark room and a studio, and I actually did make art, and I painted furniture and did all this stuff, but everything that I did was drunk, you know. I was just, and pretty soon it was less art and more drinking, you know, so that there wasn't as much time to do anything else, and it was harder to finish projects, And I was having a hard time being able to see my children, so it was recommended to me that I go to the Betty Ford Clinic. And I had already tried one rehab before. I don't know if you guys remember Capo by the Sea, but I ended up escaping and partying with my roommate. It just didn't work out. So I went to the Betty Ford Clinic, and that was 1997. And at that time, I was able to stay clean and kind of get into it, you know, while I was there for the 28 days. But I just still had that reservation. What I wanted was a magic bullet. I wanted somebody to just, you know, give me a pill, and then I was going to be normal, and I wasn't going to crave alcohol and drugs anymore, and I was going to feel okay and just get on with my life, you know? Okay, I'm a mom again. I can do all this. Just pick up where I left off, but just without, you know, being drunk. And I didn't realize that there was work involved and that I was going to have to cooperate. And I'm sure that they mentioned a higher power, but I sure as heck didn't hear it while I was there. So when it was time for me to leave, they recommended that I stay in a recovery home, like a living for women. I can't even remember. It was in Tustin for 6 months. And I was like, 6 months? Are you out of your mind? I've got kids. I've got a studio. You know, like, it's so cool. So anyway, I didn't take direction, and I was loaded within 2 days. I didn't even make it 48 hours out of there. But the one thing I took away from Betty Ford was that that methamphetamine is much cheaper than cocaine, and it lasts a lot longer. And I was so glad that I got that little bit of information, because it really was going to just help me out, you know. And so I come back, and at that time, I had this drug dealer that she lived in Westminster, and she was like this chola. She was like a mule for like a cartel. I mean, this lady, and even she looked at me, she goes, I liked it so much better when you were clean. And she wouldn't even sell to me anymore. So, you know, like what we do, I don't know, you guys probably are familiar with this, but I started seeking lower companionship. And water seeks its own level. So no matter what, I can always find what it is that I'm looking for. Like now when I look for spirituality and I look for sobriety, it's amazing how it just materializes. I can find people that I connect with on that level. But when I wanted math, I could find them anywhere, you know. And so it started this really bad downward spiral of meth and really crazy people that were coming into my life. And I was so sad because I had thrown away my marriage and I had thrown away, you know, my ability to parent. You know, by this time, you know, nobody trusts me with my children, and my ex-husband's getting remarried and he's having a baby, and the most I could do was get a dog. So I got this crazy German Shepherd, and I was just on my own. And while I was out there, I built a 2-story treehouse in a blackout, you know. And I came to, and I was like 30 feet in the air in this tree, and I had a saw going, and I was like, wow, look at this thing, you know. When did I do that? You know, and it even had like a ramp for the German Shepherd so that the dog could come into the tree with me, and so we could hang out up there. I just wanted to be high, you know. And I used to spend a lot of time on the roof. I don't know why that was either, but the Pines Park meeting, because I lived across the street from Pines Park, and I would go up there and I'd like check all the people out, because I'd been to Betty Ford. I knew what they were doing at Pines Park. And I would get my binoculars out and I would stalk the meeting, and I would try to like read their lips. What are they saying about me? I know they're talking about me. And as it turned out, they really did see me, because later, when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, I shared about it, and this lady goes, I think I saw you. So anyway, you know, I'm just getting crazier by the minute, you know. And my daughter at that time, she was about 11, and she just really didn't want anything to do with me, because she was old enough to know that things were ugly at my house. But my son was younger, and he's like, treehouse, yeah, you know. And so he got kind of more of the exposure to that than really Jennifer did. My son's 21 now. You know, at that point, I was still kind of having fun. But then really dark days came after that. And the kind of people that were coming into my home were, you know, hookers and people that were straight out of prison, and drug dealers. And most of them were homeless. And I had a lot of stuff. You know, I'd had money at one point. I used to own an art gallery. I had, you know, pretty cool little house. And bit by bit, they took everything. Like, I mean, everything. You know, I had like 8 watches. All of a sudden, I don't have none. You know, I mean, like, everything is starting to just disappear out of my life. And it was like, it was almost like a visible measure of what was happening inside of me, because I was disappearing too, you know. And I remember just looking in the mirror and just thinking to myself, God, you're dead, you know. I just was not alive anymore, you know. And but I still couldn't stop, and I just didn't know what the answer was, you know. So during all this time, I was starting to run out of money, and my neighbor, who was a real estate agent, goes, okay, you need to buy a house. You need to buy a house before you're completely out of money. And somehow in a blackout, I buy a house, you know. And I still live there, believe it or not, 11 years later. But so I was just terrified. I'm like, I can't even go over there. What am I going to do, you know? So I go to the house, and I'm slowly moving things over, and they're following me. All these tweakers that had been hanging are now coming to the new house, and it's starting to get close. And things were starting to happen. I think I was there like 2 weeks, and it was already starting to be a mess. And prior to that, these people were just so on the grift that they had turned me into the cops. You know, like, you know, someone gets busted, and then they go, give us three names, and then they give them three names, and then somebody else gets busted, and they give the same three names. So it's like the same thing going on and on and on. Well, I was one of the names. And so right before I bought that house, my house got raided. And it was on my 41st birthday, and, you know, I'm just sitting there handcuffed with my face into the carpet, you know, gun to my head, and my house is getting tossed, and I'm going, how did this happen? How did I end up here? You know, there was just like, it was unconscionable to me that it could come to this point. And even then, I just still couldn't stop. You know what I mean? I was so scared. I was so sick that day, and I was so scared. And I was too sick not to use and too scared to use. I mean, it was just like this horrible hell that I was in. So, and this is kind of how I lived for the next couple months after that raid. So anyway, I get to the new house. I'm starting to unpack and stuff, and that real estate agent came by, and he saw this girl that had been my nemesis. She was the one that that would always, you know, get the ball rolling. And he looked at her and he goes, you're going to do it again, aren't you? You're going to do the same thing to this place. And I don't even know why, but I heard him. Like, it's just one of those things that you just like go, wow, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do it. So I kicked her out, and I got everybody out of my house, and she had, like, split me some GHB or something. I mean, I was out like no woman for, like, 3 days. I mean, I could not move, and I was real sick, and I could hear people walking around my place and stuff. And so I go back to the old house to get the rest of my stuff, and everything was gone. Like, these tweakers had taken everything that I owned with my own U-Haul, including an 8-foot pool table, okay? And I was like, what? You know, and at that point, I weighed like 98 pounds. I had lost all my hair. I had been trimming my hair one time and just kept cutting. I had these little Crayola scissors. My hair was like about an inch long all over my head. I'm 98 pounds. I look crazy. You know, I can't see my children. I'm not employable. I don't know how I'm going to pay for a house. I'm just like out of my mind. And I look at this pool table being gone, and all I can think of is, that's it. I'm done. You can take my hair, my kids, my marriage, my dignity. I don't care what you take, but not the pool table, damn it. That is it. So it was just such a huge thing to lose. It was just like there was no denying this empty space in my living room. So I go, okay, that's it. I'm going to call the cops, and I'm going to report this theft, you know. And, of course, there's like a felony hanging over my head because I had been raided the week before or whatever. And so I was just like going to have get an attorney, have them walk me through the system. It was a first offense. I didn't find anything. I didn't get arrested that day, but there was definitely a warrant. So I go, I'll just turn myself in and report the theft. That's what I'll do. That's it, you know. So it's Labor Day weekend. I'm in a bathing suit, and the cops show up. And I mean, they are like looking at me going, what is this woman talking about? Because I'm going, and the pool table, and then they took this, and the tweakers, and then, they, you know. And they're all just looking at the cops like, get in the car, okay? So I turned myself in that day, and they carted me off to jail. And lucky for me, it was a holiday weekend, and there's no judge on Labor Day weekend until Tuesday. So I was there for 2 days, and I think that if it hadn't been that way, I think that either my ex-husband would have bailed me out, or my parents would have showed up, or something would have happened to get me out of jail sooner, but I had to spend the weekend in there. And, you know, I was still really high, and I was really crazy, and I was pacing back and forth. I'm in cell block A to the women's jail, and, you know, and I'm going back and forth, back and forth. And there wasn't much to read, and I was really crazy. And it was at that exact moment that I had my spiritual awakening. And I don't know what it is that one day I couldn't stop, and then one day I just knew that I couldn't go on, that there was just no way that I could keep using. And for me, I had that white light experience that Bill describes in the book. And I know that it's not like that for everyone. That's why there is, you know, chapters and, you know, all the writings about the spiritual experience. And I think that it's really different for everybody. But I just had that was one of my spiritual awakenings, because I think that we continue to have spiritual awakenings throughout our sobriety and throughout our spiritual walk. But that was the first one for me. And I knew that I couldn't do that without a God of my understanding. And that was the piece of the puzzle that I had missed when I went to Betty Ford, was the God thing, because I just didn't hear that. I wasn't really listening, but I didn't hear it. And the other thing, too, is that I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to be drunk at that point. You know, because I had been drinking vodka around the clock for 2 straight years by the time I finished, you know. And I had dispensed with glassware and ice and all that silly stuff, you know. It's just like a bottle this big of Ralph's charcoal filtered vodka and red lipstick on it, you know. So, you know, but that day I knew that I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to be drunk. And while I was in jail, they said, do you want to go to church? They offered a couple different things, and they said, there's an AA meeting. And I go, I want to go to that. Can I go to the AA meeting? You know, so I'm in my little blue jumpsuit. It's freezing in this room. And I walk in, and I'm not kidding. I could tell you every word that this lady shared that day in that jail. I could tell you her story exactly, and I can tell you what the room felt like and what the seat felt like under my bottom, because it was just so clear to me. And I heard everything that she said, and our stories were very, very different, but what was the same was the emotions that were behind it and the way that she felt on the inside, which was she felt like she didn't belong and she was not a part of and she was second best, and that the only answer was to use outside substances to feel okay, in my skin. And Chuck C. says that alcoholism is a disease of diminishing returns. And I really, really relate to that, because at the beginning, it doesn't cost us anything. And it is just, the payoff is just huge, you know. It just, bring it on, you know. And then kind of halfway through, it starts costing us a little bit, but there's still a payoff. And at the end, it cost me everything, and I was getting zero payoff. There was nothing that I was getting out of it anymore. And it didn't matter how bad of a bottom I hit. If I could pick myself up an inch off the ground, I was up and running again. So this was the bottom where there was just nowhere to go. Like, I just had really pretty much exhausted all of my options. But the real difference was that I just wanted to be sober. I really wanted it. And so I heard what that woman said, and I said, I have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the answer. Because in my head, I was like, oh, I got to go back to like a cushy little rehab and somebody that's going to have food and, you know, little meetings and stuff. But I knew that that wasn't the answer. So my parents flew out from Florida. That's where I grew up. And they almost fainted when they saw me, because they hadn't seen me in a couple of years. And I could wear my 12-year-old daughter's pants at the time. That's how small I was. And I just looked dead. I had these dark circles. You know what tweakers look like. I was pathetic. So anyway, I don't know how to describe that to you. So I was all sucked up, and I looked really scary, and I could not hold a conversation. My brains were just completely out there. And they go, you need to go to a hospital. So they took me to South Coast Hospital and dropped me off for a couple of days. You know, I kind of finished detoxing there. And they didn't come and pick me up at the time that they were supposed to, damn it, because you know that they're supposed to be there right when I expect them to, and I was pissed. So I grabbed my bags and left in my hospital pajamas and walked down Coast Highway, and I was going to go use, you know. And by the time I got home, I was so tired that I just went to sleep. And I just went, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. And when tomorrow came, I didn't want to use anymore. And that began, you know, my love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous instead of vodka. And what I did at the beginning, it was just so hairy because I was so out of it. And I mean, even taking a shower just sounded like, you know, a really big chore. I couldn't do laundry towards the end of my drinking. I couldn't, like, do anything like that. So what I would do, that's why I was in a bathing suit, because I would wear a bathing suit and then take a shower, because that way I could, like, kind of do my laundry and shower at the same time. And I really just, you know, it was disastrous. So my house, the one that I had bought, was already a mess. You know, there was just all this junk. You could tell tweakers lived there. And there was this big dog mat in the middle of one room. And I would go to a meeting in the morning, come back, and just pass out face down on this dog mat. And then when it was noon and it was time to go to another meeting, my mom would hand me a piece of chocolate and my keys, and I'd go and I'd do another meeting, and I'd come back and pass out on the dog mat. And I did that, you know, 3 meetings a day for like the first week. And then finally I showered. And that was good. And, you know, at that point, my parents were trying to tell me what to do, and I go, I need to do this myself. I need to just, it's my program. I need to get a sponsor. You can't tell me how to run my program. And my mom goes, well, what do you need, a dog sitter and a housekeeper? And I go, yes, that's what I need right now. And she goes, okay, I can do that. So my parents stayed with me for the first 4 months, and it was really good because all these tweakers were still like kind of coming around and hoping there might be more money, more drugs, whatever it was, because I was just a wealth of things to steal, you know. And but my dad would greet them at the driveway and just go, what do you want? And they finally gave up and they left me alone, and I was able to just get on with my life. And as luck would have it, when I was 2 years sober, that girl, whose name I won't mention, showed up at the Pines Park meeting, the one that like turned me into the cops, and of all things, she asked me to sponsor her. So I like actually, I sponsored her for 6 months. It was crazy. I go, I will not meet you at my house, but I'll meet you at a coffee shop. You may never come to my house again. So so that first the first couple weeks were really hard, and I felt really, really crazy. And I just, the obsession was, you know, I have an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body, and the obsession was unbelievable. And in the end, what I craved more than anything was vodka. I wasn't thinking about drugs. I just wanted to drink, you know. And I remember one afternoon I was going so crazy. I think I was about 2 weeks sober, and I just did not know what to do. And I hit my knees in my backyard. And I remember, because I think it was Mike Krisky's mom, she lived next door to me, and they were having a party or something, and I'm in there on my knees just praying. And I was like, I hope the neighbors can't see this, but I don't care, because I was just so desperate. And I got a little bit of relief, you know, and I didn't have to use. And what I found was that I had to pray as often as I used to drink, you know. And the rhythm of my drinking was like every 20 minutes, so I had to hit my knees like every 20 minutes, you know. That's what it took for me to get through a day. And I couldn't get through a day, but I could get through 10 minutes, and that's kind of how I had to do it. And when I went to, I started going to every meeting I could get my hands on. Like, I just had the you know, the little directory, and I would go to almost every meeting I could get to. And I went to this women's meeting that I still go to today, the Heritage meeting. And it used to be in San Clemente on Monday nights at Palisades Church. And we all sit in a circle, and I remember as everybody identified and gave their name and the circle went around, I just felt like this amazing feeling of like, wow, all these women are alcoholic. I cannot believe this, because they all look so normal to me. And a lot of you guys are in this room right now, and you just don't even know like what that looked like to me, to see you say that you were the same as me, but that you looked so alive and real and present, you know. So it gave me all this hope. And I heard that I needed a sponsor, so I looked around, and the lady that was sitting directly across from me was wearing the same flip-flops that I had on, and I went, oh my gosh, we have so much in common! Will you sponsor me? And she's like backing away, you know, they were all like, just like drawing straws for who was going to get me, because that was really scary. So she took me on, and she just, she says, I'll be your temporary sponsor. Why don't you call me every day for 2 weeks, and we'll see how it goes. So, I mean, when my eyes would open in the morning, the first thing that went through my head was, oh no, I'm awake. It was so scary to wake up, you know, because that meant the day was ahead, and what do I do now, you know? So I would call her first thing, oh my God, I'm awake, what should I do? She'd go, Merk, go wash your face. Okay, so I go wash my face, and I come back, oh my God, what do I do now? Why don't you dry it? You know, like, it was just like just the tiniest little thing. But she had to walk me through absolutely everything. I didn't know how to do anything. I couldn't go to the mailbox without getting loaded. I didn't know how to do anything. And everything was a trigger. Kathleen always says that life was a trigger, and I related to that so much. Life was a trigger. You know, everything reminded me of what I didn't want to be doing. And I didn't know that desire and obsession are two different things. I thought because I was thinking about something all the time that that meant that I was desiring it. I didn't know that I had a thinking problem. I didn't know that that's what obsession is, that it's not something that I need or want, but it gets in my brain, and then it just can't stop, and I start believing that lie after a while. And I love that line in the book, it's the great obsession of every alcoholic that he can control and enjoy his drinking. Because why would you want to... How could you enjoy something you're trying to control? You know what I mean? Like, it's just such an oxymoron. But that's what we do, and it made me crazy. It made me absolutely crazy. So I started to work the steps, And, you know, one was really pretty easy because I knew I was powerless. I mean, there was just no question in my mind that I was an alcoholic. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that's where I belonged. And, you know, I wrote out a list of all these hideous things that I had done and shared them with her, and I knew. But, you know, 2 and 3 was harder for me because I'm like going, okay, I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God, an entity that I can't see or touch or put my hand on it. And I have to believe, how do I do this? Like, I didn't even know what my will was, let alone how to turn it over. But what I could do was turn my will and my life over to the care of Janice. And my sponsor was willing to do what I couldn't do for me, which was just, she gave me her brain, you know, for that first year. She thought for me because I just couldn't. And so she helped me narrow it down so I'd know what the next indicated right thing to do was. And that was a big thing for me when I realized I just have to think about the very next thing. I don't need to do anything more than that. I don't need to worry about it because my life was a mess. I mean, I had legal issues. I couldn't see my children. I had trashed the house I was renting. I had a new house. I didn't have a job. I mean, I was like, my wreckage was just 10 feet deep, and I didn't know how I was going to get out of that. So I had to keep everything really, really small. And so I just went to a lot of meetings, and I worked the steps, and I prayed, and I stayed very, very close to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to you guys, and I stayed close to the women. And so at about 3 months, I figured it was time to get a job. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Harbor House, but they will hire anyone with a pulse. So they have a help wanted sign in that window that I think is at least 30 years old. Like, it's been there for so long. So I got a job there, and it was all I could do. I had to go to 2 meetings before my shift. Like, I'd go in the morning meeting and then the noon meeting, and then I could go wait tables for 4 hours, and then I'd have to go to the candlelight meeting because it was just so gnarly to even do that, you know. And the one thing I could do was wash, like, an apron, a pair socks, and a t-shirt to wear to work. And that was it, man. Like, there was no, anything more than that was just too much for me. And so I started practicing. And my drug dealer went to jail, and her children didn't have anywhere to go, so I took them. So now I'm just this wackadoo newcomer with a crazy German shepherd who stands on the kitchen sink, who used to live in a tree, and I am trying to, you know, take care of these 2 kids. And but they had been in such a bad situation that any little thing that I did for them was good. And so it helped me practice being a mom again, because I'd kind of forgotten how, you know. And once my children saw that I was parenting, they wanted to come back. So all of a sudden I had 4 kids. And but that was how I got my children back. I didn't try to go and steal them away or prove how great I was doing. God gave me these kids to take care of for 6 months, and they totally healed my ability to be present for another human being. And that was amazing to me. And so I, at that point, I got my children back, and I had joint custody, so I worked a few nights a week, and then I had my kids the rest of the time. And so I continued to work the steps, and when I got to my 4th step, I was so excited because I thought, I finally get to tattle on all these people that have done all this stuff to me. You know, I was just writing, and I'm going to tell on them, and you'll see. You know, I didn't even hear anything about the 4th column. Thank God, you know. So by the time we get to my part, I think I got through 3 resentments, and there was already a pattern of what the way that I behave. And already I could see, oh my gosh, most of the stuff I brought on myself because of the way that I think or what I expect from you. Because I have these expectations that are crazy, from other people. Way into my sobriety, I think I was 8, I did Lisa Jones is my sponsor, and I did an inventory with her that was earth-shattering for me, because I realized that, and I'm sorry to my husband Mike for this, but that I expect the man in my life to read my mind. And not necessarily because I want him to be psychic, but because I don't know what I want. I don't have any idea what I want, and so by process of elimination, it's up to you to figure it out and let me know what that is, you know? And if you don't get it right, I'm really not. So, you know, that was like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I want. Can you tell me what I'm thinking? Because I really just don't know what that is. And so that was a really important thing for me to learn about myself, because I try really hard not to make other people make decisions for me. I have to make my own decisions, and I have to ask for what I want, and I have to be willing to take no for an answer, and that's the end of it, you know? And that isn't how it used to be for me. I would do stuff for you, and then there would be a hook, because I would expect something in return, and when you didn't give it to me, damn it, then I was mad, because, but I did this, this, and the other thing. How come you're not paying me back? So it was just like selfishness to the core, no matter what. So everything that I did, there was something in it for Mert, you know. But I was that classic egomaniac with an inferiority complex, though, because no matter what, I thought that I was less than you and better than you at the same time, you know. So I continued to work the steps, and I got a better job, and pretty soon I was at Cedar Creek, and then it led to other jobs, and, you know, by the time I was 4, I was working at the Montage. I got to open that resort, and it was really great, you know. They gave me keys and codes and all kinds of stuff, and I was like, wow, you know. I remember going to the drug test and the background check, and all that stuff had fallen off of my record, and, you know, I was the administrative assistant to the banquet director, and I was a departmental trainer in the Loft restaurant, and I was a sommelier. I went through the quartermaster sommelier exam sober. I never even had to take a drink, and was able to do all kinds of crazy stuff that I know is a result of this program, because you guys have taught me how to take direction, and I became teachable here, and I became willing to listen to other people. And another thing that was really huge for me is I can accept help today. You know, because I just was, no, I got it, you know. And I would just hurt myself and everyone around me because I wasn't willing to accept your help. Mike and I got married in October, and I had so many friends. We had so many friends help us with our wedding. And it was just such a joy to be able to accept that, you know. And just and I realized that they were enjoying it every bit as much as I was, you know. And I didn't know how to do that before I got here, you know. So, once I started seeing that pattern of how I got myself into trouble, then I started getting like a clear-cut list of what my character defects were. There they were, right there in the fourth column in black and white, you know. And one of my biggest character defects is tardiness. I cannot be on time. It is just impossible, you know. And I'm not talking like 20 minutes late. I mean like days late, you know. When I was high, I was way late. And so when I first got that job at the Harbor House, which was a stupid little job that I just, you know, I drove my Mercedes and I barely made enough money to pay for gas, but I worked there. I got written up for being late, and it scared me because I really, really didn't want to lose that job. I needed it. And so that began, you know, God didn't lift it all at once, but I got better and better and better. And I can be on time today. I don't do it that often. But no, I do go to work on time. I do what I have to do, you know. And so I was amazed that that was how God dealt with that character defect. I kind of got in trouble for it, but it was good for me because I got scared. And another thing that I used to do is rage. You know, my mom was a rager. And I never knew what I was going to get, you know. She wasn't a drinker. There's no other alcoholics in my family. But she would scream and yell and break things and throw things. And, you know, one time I was fighting with her. I was a teenager. And she said something about a guitar that she'd bought me. And I said, that guitar is a piece of junk. And she picked it up and she just smashed it right next to me. And just the guitar went flying into a million pieces. And that was my role model. So I was really good at raging. That was what I did really well. And so when I was first working with my first sponsor, I started screaming and yelling about something, and she just stopped me cold, and she goes, I cannot talk to you when you're raging. And click. And I was like, I felt like I was free-falling. I was so scared because I could not afford to lose this woman. She was my brain. She was everything to me. You know, at that time, she was my connection with life because she had her feet firmly planted on the ground, and she was willing to work the steps with me, and the last thing I wanted to do was piss her off. So I had to call and make an amends and say, I won't do that again. And that was the beginning of letting go of raging, you know? And that was one of my biggest character defects. I just threw tantrums because I couldn't get my way. You know, I was still that little girl that was told, hey, take what you can get. It's good enough, you know? And I don't believe that about myself today. But I had to do a lot of work to get to that point, you know? So, you know, as time went on, I continued to work all the steps, and my life just kept getting better and better. And then stuff started happening, like real life stuff, because I think I was like in a pink cloud for like the first 4 years, you know. And I went through a relationship that really hurt me, and all of a sudden, every single piece of hurt that I had ever experienced, especially like in my marriage and childhood, just came flying forward. And I gave that specific relationship the name of what I was feeling, but what I was feeling was a lot of pain from years of being abandoned by my father. My mom was physically there, but would abandon me emotionally, and my inability to cope with disappointment. And I had to do a lot of work. And, you know, there's a reason they say for newcomers not to get involved. You know, I got into this relationship when I was 2 years sober. And by the time it was over at 4 years, I go, oh, my gosh. I've, like, enmeshed myself so much that we go to the same meetings. I don't feel safe anywhere. We have the same friends. And I had to start all over. And I need to tell you, I went to meetings in Laguna, Irvine, wherever, just so that I could get to meetings and feel safe and be able to talk about what I was feeling. And it took a really long time. And I didn't take the shortcut of getting another relationship or doing something to, I didn't shop my way through it or, you know, do anything else. I just kind of went through the pain and walked through it and did the work so that I could get healed, because I want to be an integrated, whole individual, you know. And there's different parts of me that would come up. The 12-year-old would come up, or the 16-year-old would come up. And so I had to work on every one of those, you know, like work the steps on what I was doing when I was 12 and 16 and 18, and so that I could be a whole person. And the next time I got into a dating situation, I made sure that it was someone that lived in San Diego so I didn't get into that same mess with a meeting. And so that was a much easier transition, and I learned how to date, you know. And that was a good thing for me. And I was also really willing to stay single for a long time. You know, I was single in this program for 9 years. I met my husband 2 years ago, Mike, and we have a wonderful relationship. But at the time that I met him, I wasn't looking for a relationship or thinking, you know, I had already kind of gone, I might be single the rest of my life, and that's okay, you know, because I got to do so many cool things in sobriety. It's unbelievable. When I was, right after all that stuff happened and I was in a lot of pain, I went to Mammoth for the Mammoth campout. And I hadn't been up there since back in the day when I used to use. And it was just so different for me to go up there and see the mountains through sober eyes. And to have different triggers of like riding a bike or going skiing or doing things that like I missed out on. Even though I was physically doing them, I was never present in them, because I was always thinking about the next drink or running out, because that was my fear, you know. And by going up there, that opened up a whole new world for me, you know. I met some really good friends. Two of them are here tonight. Tim and Kelly are my really good friends. And, you know, new things, new doors started to open. My world started getting big again, because it had gotten so tiny because of the way that I had chosen to live my life. And for a really long time, I would just throw my dog in the car and we'd go up there alone. And I did that about once a month for like 3 years. And I was perfectly okay going up there by myself. I loved the drive. I would listen to speaker tapes and, you know, and I had a sober group in Mammoth so I could have, that I call my home group up there, so that no matter where I go, I feel safe. And I do this wherever I travel. And my dog Luke died 3 years ago, and that was really hard. And it was bizarre. It was like harder than getting sober or my divorce or anything. That dog was amazing. He finally stopped standing on the sink, and he wasn't in a tree anymore. You know, and I learned to grieve, because I had never learned how to do that either. And my sponsor Lisa told me, she goes, this might take a really long time, you know, and you're just going to have to be sad for a while. I went, okay, I can do that. Because I didn't know how to be sad even. Like, I don't know. The only emotion that I knew was anger or fear. Those were it. That was it. I know how to be mad, and I know how to be afraid. And the two are really closely related, you know. And what I notice is that the longer that I stay sober, that the things that make me spin out, because, I mean, you could have looked at me wrong and I would have spun out for a month, you know. But the things that make me spin out, I look for frequency, intensity, and duration. And they don't happen as often, and they're not as intense, and I recover quicker. And that is the only thing that I could really hope for, because that means that I'm moving in the right direction. Life is in session. Stuff is going to happen, you know. I have a 26-year-old and a 21-year-old. I mean, my son, when he was a teenager, was gnarly. And that kid, I mean, he was in the principal's office from the time he was in preschool. He almost got expelled. And he might be one of us, I don't know, but I don't get to decide that, you know. But he's so much fun that, whoa, by the time he moved out of my house, I was like, okay, the cleaning crew's coming, come on in, you know. It was like, I was just so glad to see him go. And we have a really awesome relationship today, but we should not live together, you know. And these are some of the things that I've learned here. But I didn't have to drink over Luke dying, and I didn't have to drink over getting my heart broken, and I didn't have to drink over, you know, getting fired. I got fired in sobriety, and that was really, really scary. But it was right before I started working at the Montage, and it was the strangest thing, because I could not get hired anywhere. you know, I'm a pretty good server. I've done that for a long time. And I could not find a job, and I was scared out of my mind. I was like, what is the deal? So I took a job at the Ritz-Carlton working as a cocktail waitress. And when you're sober, working in a bar like that is really depressing. Like, I'd go to work, like, at 7 o'clock at night, and I'd cry on the way there. And it was awful. And as it turned out, I needed the Ritz-Carlton on my resume to get hired at the Montage. And I know that God had a plan there, because even though I only worked there 3 months, it ended up on my resume, and they liked that, and they hired me. So I've just found that, like, even when things aren't going my way, usually there's a, you know, a higher plan, and so I just have to trust the process. I had to trust the process even when it doesn't feel like anything is changing. You know, there was times where I've just done so much work and I want to feel different, and you know, I want to just be okay, you know. And it's just like driving through Texas. You know, you're just driving, and it's Texas, and it's Texas, and it's Texas. And then one day you're just out of Texas, you know? And that's kind of what it looks like, you know? Like, one day I just didn't feel bad, you know? And I don't know what it was that I did other than just not drink, you know? And that's one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you guys have taught me how to be uncomfortable. I have a willingness to bear discomfort today. And I have the ability to deal with unresolved issues. You know, because I used to get so crazy when something was unresolved that I would prefer to blow it up than to wait and see how it was going to get resolved, because I just couldn't wait, you know. Waiting was just out of the question. And I can bear discomfort today, no matter what it is. And it doesn't always look pretty. I mean, sometimes when I'm uncomfortable, everybody's going to be uncomfortable, you know. Is everybody crying? Okay, my job. You know, I'm good, you know. I might have to take you guys with me, but that's okay. And lucky for us in Alcoholics Anonymous, I love what Mike was saying about the fellowship, because I don't know what I would do. I would probably have only 3 friends too, you know. I have so many friends. I have hundreds of friends today. And they're real friends who love me, sometimes because of who I am and sometimes in spite of who I am, you know. I mean, that's the miracle of it, is that I can be transparent and tell you how I'm feeling, and I have friends that I stay current with. You know, my sponsor hears from me on a regular basis so that we're current. I don't need to bring her up to speed. She doesn't really need to hear, oh, and today I was, you know, this happened at work and all. But I tell her because it's current. And so she has a complete understanding of where I am today. And if something happens, she goes, oh, but did you remember the last time this happened? And I'm like, no, did this happen before? Well, yeah, like 8 times. You know what I mean? And so somebody else is keeping track for me and helping me to remember that the last time this happened, you were fine, you know? And I think that that's one of the benefits of journaling. You know, I journal like crazy. And I sometimes look at old journals, and they make me cringe. Like, you go, oh, my gosh, was that me? And I've heard that if they don't make you cringe, you're not growing. So, okay, I'll take it, you know? But I also think that we should date them, and it's a measure of not only my growth, but of God's hand on my life. Because I looked at lists. I grabbed an old journal when we went to Mammoth. We were up there last week, and I just happened to grab an old journal just because there was still some writing left to do in the back. And I opened it up, and it was a time that I had been in Mammoth at the same hotel in 2004. And it was just amazing to me, because I was reading it, and the things that I was afraid of or that were troubling me, it was like, there's a dent in my card. And, like, you know, like these little things, and I was wigging out over that stuff. You know what I mean? But I know how it all got resolved. And so some of the stuff that today seems really, really big, and, like, I don't think there's an answer, and there's no way out of this. If I read those old journals, I kind of go, well, that didn't look very good to me back then, but somehow I got through it, and it's okay. And I find that no matter what I'm going through, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous has been through it, you know, one way or another. They might not have looked pretty even getting through it, but they can share their experience, strength, and hope with me, and I have a chance of doing with you guys what I can't do by myself, you know. And when I forget to pray, you guys pray with me, or you remind me to pray. And, you know, when I'm celebrating joyful things, because happy, glad, or sad, Alcoholics Anonymous is right there with you. You know what I mean? Just like the drink was. I mean, I have found that you guys celebrate better than anybody I have ever known. You know, we celebrate and we enjoy the moment and we're happy for each other. I've learned how to be unselfish here, you know? And the one thing that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is that everything is enough today, you know? Because nothing was ever enough. No matter when it was too much, it still wasn't enough. And today I can just go, it's perfect exactly as it is, you know? And I feel good in my skin. I don't always like my circumstances, and I don't always like the conditions that are going on around me, and I might get mad at a person, or, you know, it's not perfect. There's stuff that goes wrong, but I feel good in my own skin, and my feet are planted on the ground, and I know what the next indicated right thing is. And if I don't know what it is, I'll call one of you guys, and you'll go, yeah, just get in your car, you know, because I'm thinking that it's always got to be something really big, but it's probably something really, really simple, you know? And the other thing, too, that I just kind of wanted to close with is I've heard it's spirituality described in different stages: chaos, tradition, doubt, and wonder. And I really related to that because when I first got here, everything was really, really chaotic. You know, I told you what it was like. I was passing out on a dog mat and trying to get to a meeting, and my house was a mess, and everything was just, it didn't look like it was ever going to get, the mess was ever going to get cleaned up. But I hung in. And then the next stage, I think, is when, like, after I got a year and I got into the tradition of just going to the same meetings and always showing up and calling people. And I set up, you know, rituals for myself that included meditation and calling people at a certain time and going to certain meetings and exercise. And so there was, like, a tradition that got, like, imprinted into me so that I would continue to do it. And then doubt really did happen. Like, around 7 or 8 years, I was like, wow, this is it, you know? Meetings just seemed kind of flat, and I just was kind of bored, and I don't know. There was just something weird going on with me, but tradition kept me going. No matter what, my feet still went to the meetings, and I sat there, and I just went, okay, I didn't get anything out of that, but I went to the meeting. And then it passed. You know, I don't know what that was, but I know that I'm really glad that I had a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when the doubt passed, I entered this stage of wonder, and that is a beautiful place to be, because I just don't have any answers. Like, I know less now than I did when I got here. I don't have any answers, and I don't know what it's supposed to look like, but I'm prepared to be amazed, you know, because I know that the God of my understanding has a much better plan for me and for you than anything that I can come up with. So if I trust this God, and if I do what they've told us to do, which is trust God, clean house, and work with others, I have a chance, you know? And I get to be surprised every day and just be grateful for my sobriety. I have a lot of people in this room tonight that I love, you know? And that is a direct gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an amazing program. You know, if you're new, I hope that you'll stay. If you're not new and you're thinking about leaving, I hope that you'll stay. I hope that you'll give this a chance, you know, and that you won't give up, because there's a miracle waiting. Thanks for letting me share.